Tony C., the subject of a brand new book entitled Tony C., The Triumph and Tragedy of Tony Conigliaro. And the author of that book, David Cattaneo, joins us right now on the GNM Family Market phone line. David, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What drew you to the story of Tony Conigliaro?
Actually, the publisher approached me and asked me if I was interested in doing the book, and I jumped at the chance. I was on the Red Sox beat for the Boston Herald from 1987 to 1991. And not having grown up in New England, I grew up in New York, I didn't really appreciate the Tony C. legend or his importance to fans until I went on the Red Sox beat. And when I was on the Red Sox beat, people of a certain age spoke of him in these sort of wistful terms. They had such a reverence for this guy. And when they asked me to do the book, I knew it was a good story, and I jumped at the chance.
Well, and of course, it plays out like an American tragedy, and everything coming up roses when he broke into the league in 1964, a home run champion at 20 years old, and the talent that Tony C. possessed was absolutely real.
It was, and therein, I think, is where the people find that wistfulness, and it's the classic what might have been story. Somebody who showed a lot of promise at a very young age, and then when it's cut down at a very young age, their imaginations have a lot of, there's a lot of fuel for your imagination that anything could have been possible. I mean, he was 22 when he got hit, which effectively ended the greatness that he had. I mean, he had some great years afterwards, just on sheer will. But he was 22, and you realize that Carl Yastrzemski did not come into his own until 1967, when Yaz was in his 28th year. So ball players at 22 are just a work in progress. And Tony C. could have been anything, basically.
Well, I remember that night as a kid very well, in August of 67, hit by that pitch. He missed the rest of that year, all of the 1968 season, and then came back, was comeback player of the year in 1969, and oddly enough, had his most productive season in 1970, 36 homers, 116 RBIs, and then after the fact said, I did that with one eye closed because he had double vision.
Yeah, he did, and part of the story that after he sat out the 68 baseball season, but in the fall of 68, he got it in his head that he would come back as a pitcher.
Right.
That's
right.
How much he wanted to come back and play big league baseball. That didn't work out. But he worked at it, and he went to the Winter League, and he pitched. What he did in 69 and 70, he really did do it with maybe one and a half eyes. When he was injured, it changed his vision just enough so that his depth perception was thrown off. And over time, the brain, I know this from talking to the doctors and stuff when I did the book, the brain can adjust to a certain amount so that you can regain some sort of depth perception. But he never had what he had before he got hit. And he did it on sheer will for the most part.
And we mentioned that he enjoyed every bit of that celebrity. He had a recording contract for a while, was dating Hollywood starlets, and I guess was living the dream of any 20-something kid in Boston back in the 60s.
Was. I mean, I recount the story in the book where he's driving through Kenmore Square. He's like 24 years old. He's in a red Corvette. It's a summer night. He just hit a home run for the Red Sox, and he's going on to the town. And it's like, like you said, living the dream. And part of his story is that he was different from, he broke in 64 when he was 19. He was one of the first. Technically, he wasn't a baby boomer because he was born in July of 45, but he really was the first baby boomer sort of baseball star. And there was a real generation gap that the young people really embraced him with. He was not that modest. He didn't want to wait his turn. He said he sang rock and roll records, and he went out with starlets who were 20 years older than he was. And a lot of older people, the older press members, some of the coaches, you know, World War II Depression era guys, didn't like this kid so much who was kind of brash and played his music too loud, but younger people just went crazy for him. He was the perfect. perfect celebrity for those times.
Yeah, and wasn't there a little friction, too, between Tony C., who had all of this natural ability, and Carl Yastrzemski, who had to work really hard to get where he got in Major League Baseball?
There was a natural rivalry early on. In 67, as you certainly remember, you know, that was the year of Yaz. Yaz raced way ahead of him in terms of superstardom after that. There was some friction afterwards, and the Red Sox clubhouse, in certainly in 1970, it had its factions. There was a Yaz faction, and there was a Tony C. faction. For whatever reason, Reggie Smith was involved. It was really a kind of a toxic clubhouse. But when Yaz was interviewed for this book, he had nothing but respect, in retrospect, and admiration for Tony C. and his talent. So a lot of that stuff dissipates, of course, over time. But in the heat of the clubhouses in those days, there was some friction, yes.
Well, and you also had the family factor, too, with his brother Billy Coniglio being a part of the team.
That was partly is what fueled the feud in the clubhouse, in that you had Billy C., you had Tony C., and you had Yaz and Reggie Smith, and people were just picking sides. We've all worked in offices or lived in places where that happens, and it happened in that clubhouse, unfortunately, for Tony and for Yaz to some extent.
We're talking with author David Cattaneo. The book is entitled Tony C., The Triumph and Tragedy of Tony Coniglio. And the tragedy began with that beaning in 67. And then, boy, it continued. He tried to come back in 75. That was pretty short-lived. Here's a guy who was part of two American League championship teams and never got to taste the postseason himself. And then had some business failures and then was in the process of trying to become a Red Sox broadcaster when he suffered the heart attack and the stroke that ultimately would lead to his death.
Correct. He interviewed for the Red Sox color commentator job that Hawk Harrelson was leaving at the time. And by all accounts, as far as I could piece together, the job probably would have been his. And looking at it, he was a natural. He literally was a local boy. He had that little greater Boston accent that would endear himself to people around here. He was blunt. And it's not difficult to imagine that he would have been a presence, a Jerry Remy-like presence for another couple of generations of Red Sox fans. Because by all accounts, he would have been great at that job. And then he's being driven to the airport after auditioning for it by his brother, and he had a heart attack, and his brain was deprived of oxygen for too long, and basically he suffered brain damage, for lack of a better term, which debilitated him for the rest of his life.
What was the most surprising thing you learned about Tony C. in your research?
The most surprising thing was that it was the part that, I mean, I knew, again, just from soaking it up. I knew that he was brash. I knew that he was a sort of a playboy. I knew that he didn't wait for his stardom. So he had this reputation as being this cocky kid. The part that we didn't know back in Boston was really what was going on with him when he went out to California. He got a job in the San Francisco area doing sports, you know, the local sports, at 6 and 11. And there was kind of a gap in his story, and in my research, talking to people who knew him out there, and some people knew him really well, he grew up out there, and those people talked about him looking back on his career, and like most of us did when we get into our 30s, we look back when we were in our 20s, and he was sort of, you know, man, I overdid it, I should have done that, and he was, there was a sweet, serious, really compassionate side to him that I learned about when I interviewed the people who knew him in San Francisco.
Well, and what's interesting, too, is that he's sort of in that pantheon of those who died young athletically in Boston, Harry Aganis and Tony Coniglio. But you think back to the James Deans of the world that are in the image of a lot of fans, still that 22-year-old that could just crush the ball and have that perfect Fenway Park swing. But for the family, I'm sure it's a very different memory of Tony C.
The family, it was a huge blow to the family. He had a very tightly knit family, very supportive family. And his father was a guy who cared about his son very much. Obviously, he loved him very much, and he pushed him. And part of his pushing him was to help him achieve greatness. And talking to his father had died by the time I did the book. But talking to his family members, they still feel a sense of shock and disbelief. They couldn't believe it, that all this promise in the middle of this dream season, 1967, the impossible dream, Boston baseball has been revived. They're the talk of the town, and he gets hit, and this happens to him. They still couldn't believe it all the years later that with one pitch, so much had changed.
I know that there are those in Boston who also believe that his number should be retired at Fenway Park. Did people talk with you about that along the way?
They had, and that's one that was part of when I was covering the Red Sox. That was a main source of my knowledge. That boy, they really loved this guy. I mean, he didn't play that long, and you know his statistics were not outstanding over the course of his career. But he was so beloved that people were very adamant about wanting to retire his number. And after researching the book and hearing his story firsthand, I can understand why.
Well, I'm trying to think if it was during your tenure covering the Sox, but one of the ultimate indignities at the end there, the night that they were honoring him, Tony C. Knight at Fenway Park, was also the night when Buddy LaRue staged his ownership coup.
Yeah, that was before I was working. I worked for the Herald at the time, but I wasn't on the beat. But I remember that fiasco. There's no other word for it.
Mm.
I just remember that fiasco very, very vividly, and it was just talk about poor timing. Remember that night, and he was. He was worth more than that. Let's put it that way. And those, I think the reputations of those two people involved, LaRue and Sullivan, were damaged beyond just from what went on, but when it went on Tony C. Knight.
Well, I can't wait to read the book as somebody who grew up looking up to Tony Conigliaro. David Cattaneo, the book is entitled Tony C., The Triumph and Tragedy of Tony Conigliaro. Thanks so much for chatting with us this afternoon, and we wish you well with the book.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.